Good morning, everyone. I would like to welcome you to our 2015 annual client education event. And I would like to introduce Bill Anderson, the founder and managing partner of the Anderson Firm, to get us started this morning. Bill?
Might be on mute there, Rhonda.
Yeah. Bill, are you on the line with us? Okay, we may be having some technical difficulties. If you all will bear with me just one second, please. Okay, good morning, everyone. I'd like to welcome each of you to our 2015 annual client education event. I would like to introduce Bill Anderson, the founder and managing partner of the Anderson Firm, to get us started this morning. Bill?
Good morning, everyone. After 25 years of serving clients, we realize there are only two pieces to our business. One is bright people to give good information and service, and clients to serve. And so we appreciate you being here. We do only four things: estate planning, estate settlement, estate litigation, and asset protection. On those, we have found that the law has been rapidly changing. So we needed a way that we could stay in touch with our clients, not to have just a transaction, but an ongoing conversation. So for years, we've been having this annual client education, and many will listen on the phone today. Others will look at it on our website, but it's our way year after year where, number one, we can tell you what's been going on in the law, tell you anything new, and give you an opportunity to ask questions. And so as you go through this, at the end there will be questions. You can also pick up the phone and call us. So with that, let me turn it over to Jim Collins.
Good morning, everyone. I'd like to take just a couple of minutes and update you on any important tax law changes. Unlike some years we talk, 2015 has been fairly quiet. So let me center in on, you are aware that the IRS and the government limits you on how much you can transfer or gift to individuals during your lifetime or after death without paying a tax on those transfers. We call those gift taxes or estate taxes. The two most important numbers is to remember that in 2015, upon your death, you can pass as an individual up to $5.43 million to anyone you want free of estate tax. Anything above that would be at a 40% estate tax rate. For the last few years, this number has been indexed for inflation. It went up $90,000 last year, and if it goes up another $90,000, we could see something like a $5.52 million exemption from estate tax. And do realize if you're listening as a couple, that would be is currently a $5.43 million amount each, which means a couple could pass away and leave the first $10.86 million free from taxation on that transfer. If you make transfers during your life above a certain amount, the tax that would be subject to is gift tax. And most of you realize you are free to transfer, again, individually to as many people as you want, up to $14,000 without filing a gift tax return or anything. This number goes up $1,000 every few years. It has not gone up for a while, so we may see it rise in January or maybe in another year. We will keep you posted as every year in mid-November, the IRS releases a document that tells us what happens to these inflation-adjusted numbers. The other thing I would mention as to tax law changes is that you need to be aware of changes in your own state of residence or domicile. A number of states have their own separate transfer tax systems, either death tax, estate tax, gift tax, and that kind of thing. And those things change on a regular basis as well. Just as a brush, for instance, some of you may be listening from New York State, and their separate estate tax system is in a process of annually raising a certain amount every year. And by 2019, January 1 of 2019, you will be able to leave the same amount exempt from estate tax at the New York State level as you leave at the federal level, with a couple of twists in that law. And really, that that update just catches you up on the appropriate important numbers that we have. There really have not been a lot of major changes, and we will, again, keep you posted as we become aware of anything. I would like at this point to turn things right back to my partner, the founding partner of the firm, Bill Anderson, and he's going to talk about one of our very most effective high net worth planning tools and some potential attack those tools might be under. Bill?
Thanks, Jim. I would like everyone to picture in their mind four different silos, and that's how we go about planning your estate. The first silo is about your basic planning. Everyone here, virtually everyone, would have used a revocable living trust to avoid probate and give good asset protection. The second silo is the planning for your IRA, so it is, or 401k, so it is protected for the next generation. The third silo is what I'm getting ready to talk about, and that is taxes. And the fourth silo is the asset protection. So let's talk about estate taxes. And here, as Jim mentioned, we're talking about both our federal estate tax, which now is $5.43 million we can pass, our state estate tax, which has real peculiarities. Florida has none. As Jim mentioned, New York is stepping up. New York has a peculiarity, though, that once you reach that $5.43 million, go just a little over, you get taxed from dollar one all the way up. So the issue becomes, how do we go about dealing with those estate taxes? There are a limited number of ways that you may choose to just pay the tax. Not many of our clients choose that. You can take the fun option. You can just spend it all. Three, you can give it all to charity. Those are all options. You can start gifting plans to your children. You can move to a state that does not have a state estate tax, like those in many states, for example, Florida, where we practice quite a bit, have done. You can insure against it and just say, this is the number I'm going to insure for. And you can calculate that pretty easy on the back of an envelope. If you're a single person and you have $10 million, you say, for federal purposes, I have $10 million minus five, it's $5 million times 40%. That's $2 million in federal taxes. And if you're a New York resident, 10 million times 16%, I got $1.6 million, and I'm not going to make any more money going forward. I'm going to spend it all. So you got a $3.6 million tax bill. So you insure. Well, let's say you don't like any of those options, or for some reason the insurance does not work for you. Jolene Searles, in a minute, is going to talk about a variety of techniques that can be used. But the most important technique, the 800-pound gorilla of estate planning, is called a sale to a grantor deemed owner trust, or a GDOT, a GDOT. It's also called an intentionally defective grantor trust, an IDGET. Don't worry about the names. Just remember it as the 800-pound gorilla. And in the simplest terms, we put, let's say, either cash or your securities account, your investment account, non-IRA assets, real estate investment into an LLC, a limited liability company. You still maintain total control. and then we set up an irrevocable trust, and we sell interest. It's a sale, not a gift. We sell interest over to that irrevocable. Now, the magic of this is you are still the manager of the LLC. You still control the assets, but we have dirtied those assets up so that only you control them, meaning that if you're selling them over to a trust that your children are the beneficiary of, they can't borrow against them, they can't demand a dividend, they can't sell them, they can't do anything. So would you pay 100 cents on the dollar for that type of investment? The answer is clearly no. So we can take a major discount in what the IRS views those assets for. And when they are sold over, all of the future appreciation is out of your estate. This is the 800-pound gorilla. And then, as I have said before, you maintain control. If you need more money coming back on the note, you get advance payments. You can make loans. You can call the note. So it's a technique where high net worth and ultra high net worth clients are able to dramatically reduce the estate taxes. Now, what is going on is that for the last 7 years, this has been on the president's list of legislation to disallow part of the discount. The left side, when we discount the value. This year, the president has said that instead of going about this through legislation, they're going to do it by regulations. They're going to do it by regulations. And so recently, we had Kathy Hughes, who is the estate and gift tax attorney advisor in the Office of Tax Policy at the Treasury Department, indicated that regulations would be coming out that would restrict dramatically or do away with these discounts. So the only message that you need to take away on this is that if you have an estate tax issue and you don't want to use one of the other techniques I was talking about, like spending it all or giving it all to charity or paying the tax, and you don't like the insurance piece, this is something we need to deal with sooner rather than later to get the full benefit of this 800-pound gorilla. All right. So with that, then, let me turn it over to Jolene Searles, who is going to talk about some other advanced planning techniques.
Thank you, Bill. So now that you all know about the 800-pound gorilla, I want to talk to you about some of the other estate planning animals. As Bill mentioned, once you know that you may have a taxable estate, it's important to look at different planning options for that estate and to start planning as soon as possible, because the sooner we plan, the more options that we have. So what are some of those options? First of all, we can set up a qualified personal residence trust. This is a special trust for your house. You can put a home or a vacation home in there. You keep the right to live there for the rest of your life, but you can move the value of that home outside of your estate for a fraction of what it's worth. We can turn to some gifting options. As Bill mentioned, people love to gift. It's their way to see people enjoy the benefit of those gifts. So you can do spousal gifting trusts, which we call BERTs. You could do legacy trust for kids, grandkids, nieces and nephews, friends, family members. And into those trusts, you can gift either that $14,000 a year that Jim mentioned, or you can make larger gifts using part of that $5.43 million exclusion. We can use life insurance. As Bill mentioned, one of the options is to pay the tax. And life insurance is the easiest way to make sure that you have the cash to pay that tax. But we want to make sure that that insurance doesn't get included in your estate. So we set up a special trust. We move that insurance outside of the estate, and then when the time comes to pay the bill, we've got the cash in there to write the check. Bill also touched on using family limited liability companies to to be able to gift more while keeping the ability to manage and control those assets and discounting the value of that gift. And whether you use those in conjunction with the intentionally defective grantor trust or whether you use those with some of these other techniques, limited liability companies are a great way to plan for your estate. He also talked about the importance of the IRA inheritance trust. This isn't so much reducing your taxable estate, but it's an incredibly important technique to make sure that that IRA upon your death is completely protected and that you can make sure that your kids, your grandkids, other beneficiaries have the ability to stretch that IRA out over their lifetime. So we've got that stretch and we've got the protection from the creditors, the predators, the divorcing spouses, and sometimes from the kids themselves who may not know what an IRA is supposed to be used for at 18 years old. So we encourage all of you to look at your estate. If you don't have enough planning in place, sit down and talk to us. Give us a call. We'd love to talk to you about some of these techniques and make sure that we have you set up to either minimize or eliminate that estate tax. So with that said, I am going to turn it back over to Bill to talk to you about the importance of protecting those trusts once we get them in place.
Thanks, Joe. For not just decades, but for centuries, trust and estate law was static. You did a will, you went through a probate process, you dumped the assets out. The last 30 or 40 years has been one of the most dynamic times in trust and estates law. We've moved away from wills into trust. We have all sorts of tax trusts, IRA trusts. It has become a very, very narrow and specialized area of the law if it's going to be done correctly. But with the law changing, the issue becomes when you sit down to do your estate plan, how do you make sure that either a court or a legislature doesn't come on behind you, either when you are mentally disabled or it's gone to sit on your cloud and change it on you and destroy your intent? So a number of years ago, starting in the Northeast, a notion called a trust protector came about. And a trust protector is someone that you appoint who can go in after your disability or death with the permission of your beneficiaries to implement your intent. Now, they can't go in and name themselves as a beneficiary, but they can go in if you intended to do certain things with your trust, and then it is challenged or a court says, no, you can't do that, and rewrite the trust to make sure it happened. So I would like to tell you the story, and this story is a true story. It just came about in the last year, in 2014, and it's published in a lot of the books called, the name of the case is Manassian versus Rachins. So it's a case where it was a husband and wife, second marriage. They were very much in love, and they ended up in a situation where dad passed away. Their estate plan had specifically said it was for her benefit. This is all in the published case, for her benefit. Whatever was left over would go to the stepchildren. Well, the stepchildren didn't like that and then sued to stop her and restrict her spending. Fortunately, they had a brilliant estate planner who had put the trust protector in and named himself as the trust protector. And that state did not have a trust protector law at the time. And so this was litigated up through the courts. And now it is law that, yes, you can use a trust protector. The trust protector went back in and rewrote the provisions in the trust to get around any objections that a judge had. And so now the grantor's intent was fully carried out. I'm being a little facetious on the lawyer and the law firm because I was the trust protector and our law firm is the one who did that. But you really, in all seriousness, you need to be able to make sure that you have named someone to safeguard your intent going forward. All right. So that's where we are on trust protector. And at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Erin Turner, and Erin is going to talk about trustees.
Thanks, Bill. I want to give us a little refresher on trustees first. If we'll remember, a trustee is the person who is in charge of the trust. They are the ones who have control over the assets. They may or may not be a beneficiary, but they are the quarterback, for lack of a better term, over the trust assets. So when we're choosing a trustee, we only have five options. The first one is to be the individual yourself. In a lot of cases, you're not able to do that in an irrevocable trust. And obviously, after a person has passed on, they can't serve as their own trustee. The second option is the beneficiaries. If a beneficiary handles money fine and they're able to manage the assets and we're comfortable with them doing that, it's a good idea to have them serve as a trustee. Third option is a family member. If we have someone who we know and trust and is a member of the family, they could serve as the trustee. The fourth option is to name a professional, an attorney, a CPA, some other individual to serve as your trustee. And then the fifth option is an institutional trustee or a corporate trustee. And a lot of people have asked us questions over the years about the pros and the cons of corporate trustees. And I want to take just a minute and go through those pros and cons. We'll start with the cons, and it's pretty easy. There's really one big drawback to naming a corporate trustee, and that's a fee. A corporate trustee is going to charge a percentage of the value of the assets that are in the trust that they're managing every year for their services. And the reason they charge a fee is because they have a fiduciary duty. They're responsible for a number of things, as all trustees are, and they're going to be compensated for those services. We've worked with all the major banks, all the large trust companies, and we've seen a fee range anywhere from 0.5% on up to 1.5% to maybe even 2%. It's going to depend on the nature and the makeup of the assets in the trust. The long and the short of it is a trust has to have a trustee. It's like a captain on a ship. If we don't choose a trustee or the trustees that we've chosen don't pan out or unwilling or unable to serve, the court's going to appoint a trustee. So by choosing a corporate trustee, the benefits we can get are professionalism. These folks do this for a living. They have a fiduciary obligation to abide by the terms of the trust to provide for the benefit of the beneficiaries. They're good at record keeping. We need to have accurate records in place to make sure that we account and inform the beneficiaries in a timely manner. They have the liability insurance. If they screw something up, a corporate trustee, if we've chosen the right one, we'll have the deep pockets to come out and make the beneficiaries whole again. They also have the ability to act indifferent. They're not going to be bombarded with the family baggage that some of us have in our families and should show no favoritism towards one beneficiary over the other. Corporate trustees don't get sick. They don't go on vacation. They don't have the same issues that individuals have. So it's nice to know that a corporate trustee is going to be there every day, day in and day out. And the last one and the biggest one probably for the corporate trustee is to have somebody who speaks the language, someone that can assist the CPA in filing tax returns, someone who can work with the estate attorney on settling the estate and working through any issues that come up in the future. So a corporate trustee does have some downsides, but there are many upsides. If anybody has any individual questions about corporate trustees or needs a recommendation, please feel free to give us a call. I'm happy to talk to anybody who's considering a corporate trustee. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Jim.
Thank you, Aaron. Let me talk to you about what is so bad about probate. Our firm very much enjoys helping people avoid the probate court process, and specifically to avoid will-based planning, estate planning centered around a last will and testament that guarantees you ending up in probate. People are confused about what causes probate, and even some believe having or not having a will is what takes you to probate or not. In reality, if I can simplify this for you, only one thing on the planet causes probate, and that is if you pass away with an asset or assets that are strictly in your individual name. No joint owner, no transfer designations, no beneficiary designations, or better yet, by far, no revocable trust that owns the assets. I like to tell people that if you die and your name is the only name on an asset with no further rules, then the only person who can tell us where that asset goes next is 6 feet under. And I also like to say that therefore probate is for when we have to probe. Now we have to probe to figure out where that asset goes, and we must, therefore, if you leave yourself in this situation, go to probate. Are by far and away the most solid estate planning tool to avoid this is to have a good counseling-oriented, up-to-date, revocable living trust. And then that revocable trust, like an ownership box, owns all of your assets and names beneficiaries. Having said that, what do clients not like about probate? What do we not like about probate? I've always told clients three things, and Bill Anderson's son, Will, in our firm recently wrote an article and has changed my perspective, and I will add a fourth. But quickly, we don't like probate because it's time-consuming. It can take months or years. It is also, number two, expensive. It varies greatly. In Florida, for instance, this can be 3 to 5% of the assets going through probate. Number three, we don't like it because it's a public court proceeding. It opens an opened wound that others can attach or latch onto because we already have a court proceeding flowing. Now, I like what Will Anderson has added as a fourth. Not only is it time-consuming and expensive and a public process and court proceeding, but number four, it is a gigantic hassle for your family. It introduces hassle and difficulties that you really don't need to leave behind for your family. And then the last thing I'd like to mention is really clearing up a misconception, and it is a very dangerous misconception. A lot of people believe, therefore, if they do a trust, that there's nothing to do when you pass away. I have an attorney friend in Cleveland, Ohio, who likes to say that a trust is not a magic book. It does not sprout its own arms and legs. It doesn't jump down off the shelf after you pass away and run around and settle its own affairs and take care of itself. Quite frankly, there are still legal steps that need to be done when you pass away, even with the trust. There are things that are musts that you need legal counsel with and your family will need help with. But the great blessing when you use the trust is that we can keep the court out of the process. And really, that is the tremendous difference. I would like to turn the conversation back over to my partner, Jolene Searles. And Jolene is going to talk about one of the most important or one of the biggest changes in estate planning that we've seen this year and over the last few years. Jolene?
Thanks, Jim. So we've had several big developments for same-sex marriage over the last few years, with the Windsor case first, and then recently the Obergefell case. Between these two cases, the Supreme Court has ruled that same-sex marriage is a fundamental right that has to be legally recognized in all states and that all couples that are married have to be granted all of those rights and benefits available to married couples. So things like parenting, the estate planning techniques that we've talked about, Social Security benefits, divorce benefits, the elective share benefits, those types of things. So because of these changes, it's important for all couples that have gotten married, whether they're same-sex couples or opposite-sex couples, to update your estate plans to make sure that we're taking advantage of all those benefits, that we're maximizing your planning options, and that we're setting everything up exactly the way that you want it set up. We also strongly encourage unmarried couples to get their estate plans in place. Because there can be a number of problems that arise if you're not married and don't have planning in place. So we just want to make sure that we've got all those problems and complications provided for. Now that we've discussed the importance of getting your estate plan in place, we want to make sure that your assets are protected. So I'm going to turn it over to Jerry Sureski to talk to you all about asset protection.
Thanks, Jillian. Good morning, everyone. So, I'll be talking about asset protection this morning. I'm not going to be too technical, just going to keep it, touch the basics, the main points. So what is asset protection? There is a misconception out there that you protect your assets by hiding your assets. That is just not so. Asset protection is taking advantage of existing laws that can help you shield your assets from your creditors. Asset protection is to add layers around your asset, dirtying the ownership of the asset, so you force your creditor to peel off those layers before they can get at the asset. Of course, that takes some time and money, and creditors don't want to do that, so they come to the negotiating table with a much better settlement offer. So let's go through the basics. Our retirement plans. For you and your spouse, they are protected. If you live in Florida, your homestead is protected. Life insurance are protected, and annuities are protected. So what about the other stuff, like your gold, your investment accounts, your investment properties, things of that nature? Well, there are ways that you can plan for those things while you're alive as well. Now, it is primarily important that you plan as far in advance as possible. Why is this? Because of statutes that deal with fraudulent transfers. So fraudulent transfer basically says that you know that you have some litigation coming or you actually have some litigation going right now, so you say, well, you know what, before my creditor takes it, I'm just going to move it into an LLC, a corporation, give it to my, you know, next door neighbor or something like that, anything to keep it away from the hands of the creditors. Now, the main consideration for determining whether something, a transfer is a fraudulent one, is time. Time is very important. So the earlier you start planning, the stronger your argument is that you did not transfer your asset to defraud your creditors. So often our clients ask me or they tell me, but Jerry, I don't have any litigation pending. I'm not really afraid that anybody's going to come after me. There's no rush. Why should I start planning now? And that's exactly why, because the earlier you start planning, the better argument you have and the stronger asset protection you will have. So how do we do all this? Well, for retirement plans, remember, for you and your spouse, it's protected as it is. For your beneficiaries, as Jolene and I think Bill told you already, we use the IRA Inheritance Trust, and that protects it for your beneficiaries as well, among all the other benefits that they discussed. Now, for investments, it gets a little bit more complicated. By investments, I mean stocks, brokerage accounts, gold, and investment real estate, and things like that. So I'm sure that most of you heard of limited liability companies and corporations and how they protect your assets. And I also often hear, well, I'm good. I put my fill in the blank into an LLC, so I'm good. And that is just a shallow thinking. It's there's a lot more considerations to it. Without getting too technical or giving more information than I can give in 5 minutes, an LLC is, or the protection that the LLC affords is dependent on what state it is organized under. So, for example, Florida, if you have a Florida LLC, it is virtually worthless. It does not protect your assets. If you have an LLC in New York, same deal. If you have an LLC in Tennessee, well, it's much better. Still not great, but it's much better. If you have an LLC or a corporation that it's owned by one single person, depending on the state, it is not very well protected. It is if you have an LLC that has more than one owners, members, then you're much better protected. So you see, there's a lot of considerations just to say, well, I have my assets in an LLC, so I'm good. That's not the whole story. So let me tell you what we do. We use the Wyoming Close LLC. Wyoming Close LLC. And what is this? Well, it's a limited liability company organized under the laws of Wyoming. So am I telling you that you move your assets to Wyoming? No. All we do is just we organize the LLC under the laws of Wyoming, and then you transfer your assets into it. Your assets stay where they are right now. They just take advantage of the laws of Wyoming, which are the best in the country when it comes to asset protection. It is an incredibly powerful LLC by statute that says your creditors just cannot take it, and the best they can hope for is a charging order. What is a charging order? Say that you get a judgment against you, and the judge says, well, I cannot give the LLC to your creditors, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to order that whenever you distribute money out of that LLC, instead of going to you, the owner, is going to go to your creditor. You remain in control of that LLC. So knowing this, are you going to distribute any money out? Of course not. So really this forces your creditor to come to the negotiating table and says, look, I know what you've done. I know the best I can get is this charge and order, which I don't want. So just give me some money and I'll go away. It puts you in a very good, strong bargaining position. Then we also use the Wyoming Domestic Asset Protection Trust. This is a trust where you put your stuff and you keep using your stuff, you keep control of your stuff, but it stays out of the protected. Your creditors just cannot get it. This is Wyoming's way of it's an attempt to get at the business, at the offshore business. The idea is instead of people taking their money offshore, they keep it in Wyoming and affording this similar type of protection. But there is an annoyance to this, and that is that you have to have a Wyoming resident trustee to act to be the trustee of this asset protection trust. There is a way around that as well, and that is to create your own trust company. I know that sounds fancy, sounds big, but it's really very simple. It is just a simple Wyoming LLC that exists for the sole purpose of acting as the trustee of your asset protection trust. You remain in control. You get to use your assets, and you keep your property out of the hands of your creditors. So to summarize this technique is you have a Wyoming Close LLC, which is powerful by itself, that owns your property. Then you have the Asset Protection Trust, which owns the LLC. And then you have the trust company to manage everything, and you manage the trust company. So the end result is that, again, you retain control of your property. You get to use your property, but your creditors just cannot take it. It is an incredibly powerful tool. We call this the cowboy cocktail just because it's out of Wyoming, so that's what we call it. There's one more thing to this, is that if you plan far ahead in advance, it can even protect you from your assets from bankruptcy. Okay, so that's all I got for you folks, and with that, I'm going to turn it over to Bill Anderson.
Hey, Bill, are you on mute?
Aaron, would you like to cover this next topic?
Let's give him 1 minute. Do we know, can we see if he's got a phone issue?
I'm checking with him now.
I'm back with you. That's what happens when you hit the disconnect button instead of the unmute button. All right. Let me talk now about our last issue before we open it up for questions. And that's what happens when everything goes bad. And that is estate litigation. Estate litigation is a burgeoning area of the law. 30 years ago when I started practicing, there really wasn't that much estate litigation. Oh, yeah, it occurred from time to time. But this generation, this two or three generations, has created so much incredible wealth prior to our ancestors, there's a lot much more to fight over. In addition to that, we end up having so many blended families. And so with a second or even a third spouse, with stepchildren. So there are three ingredients that go into estate litigation. And those three ingredients are death, money, and greed. And so there are some very important things to plan for in advance, and I'm going to get to those. But let me tell you first what folks pay attention to, like us, when we're either defending or bringing an estate litigation case. And there's the old saying in the law that paper will put up with whatever you write on it. So folks will say to me, Bill, have I now done everything to avoid estate litigation? And the answer is twofold. Yes, but that does not mean that somebody cannot sue. We have a very different system of a judicial system in the United States than, for example, in the Brits have. In the Brits, you lose, you pay. You pay the other side's fees. We don't work that way, and it is a true statement that our judicial system is not necessarily about justice. It's about resolving disputes. And so the first thing we look at is lack of capacity. And so we say, does that person have the mental capacity to be able to execute an estate plan? So is that a real high level? No. It means you know who you are, more or less what you have, and third, who you want to give it to. I will give you this scenario. I was working with a very nice gentleman in New Jersey, and he wanted to leave certain assets to his significant other. He said, there will be estate litigation in this. He said, I know. I have one child who is an attorney and another child who very much dislikes my significant other. What do I do? So one of the things we do, because he had some very serious age on him, before we executed his estate plan, we had him to go off and to get a note from his primary care physician and a neuropsychiatrist that he had mental capacity. So sure enough, shortly after he passed away, here came the estate litigation. It just all stopped in its tracks, because what do you say when two doctors have said this person has mental capacity? The second is undue influence. There is the saying that as each and every one of us become older, children become parents, and parents become children, meaning that we rely on people more. Now, that could be a child. It could be a caregiver. It could be someone who has gotten into our good graces. And so there are certain things you look at to see whether it was a caretaker or a relative. Was there some type of undue influence? Did that person become a trusted advisor? Did they tend to alienate people away from them? Did they take that person to the lawyer themselves? Was the estate plan written in a different and unusual way? So it was changed from a third, a third, a third to the three children to 80%, which I had in one case, and 10% to the others. The next is the lack of formalities. It just has to be done right. Folks say, well, you know, we design the plan, you create the plan, you have it reviewed twice, then we come in, we have the notary and the witnesses, and everybody's got to stay here. We have this delivery ceremony, and nobody can leave the room, or it's got to stop until everybody gets back. The reason is, if you don't do it right, the estate planning documents are not valid. There are also issues of breach of fiduciary duties. Aaron talked some about that on the duties of the trustee, elective shares, forged documents, and the like. But estate litigation is incredibly expensive because folks view it as not fighting with their own money. And greed comes into it. And the issue also becomes, I have watched it just tear families apart. So to the extent that you can, if you see the litigation coming, think through what you have put together and determine whether it can cause you some problems. So with that, let me turn it to Angela Christian. Angela?
Thank you, Bill. This is Angela Christian Hooper. And I do have one reminder for everyone this morning before we start the question and answer session, which we are just about ready to do, and that is to make sure your plan is up to date. As you all heard Jim say earlier, your estate plan is not a magic book with wings or arms and legs that can jump off the shelf and take care of itself. So if you have had changes to your family or your beneficiary or your financial status, then it may be time to review your estate planning document. If you're wondering if something is happening, you don't know if it requires a change, call us. We're here for the long haul. We're going to be with you throughout this entire process. It's a very long-term relationship here. So we're here. If you have questions, feel free to call us. We'll talk about what's changed and help you decide whether it requires a change to your estate planning documents. I know that we reviewed a lot of information today rather quickly. Some of it you've heard before, and some of it we talked about may be completely new to you. So if you have questions about those things, please feel free to ask those during this next question. If you're comfortable doing that, then you can call us afterwards. We are a unique firm. We strive to make every client have the ultimate client experience. And we look forward to being with you and your family and your friends and others who may have estate planning needs. We welcome those referrals. So what happens next? If you have questions, again, or you think you need a change to your document, or you've heard something about a technique that you're interested in and may benefit you, then feel free to call us. I'm available. Mel Campbell and Dawn Horowitz are all available to take your calls and find time to assist you. And that number is 866-230-2206. So now we are getting ready to start the question and answer session. I'm turning this call back over to our Vice President, Rhonda Miller.
Thanks, Angela. And I'd also like to thank Bill, Jim, Jolene, Aaron, and Jerry for that very useful and interesting presentation this morning. A lot of good information. And I do want to ask everyone to bear with me just one moment while we conclude our recording of the presentation, and then we will prepare to open the floor up for questions. So just one moment, please.